So, okay, here's what I want to know. So you're staying with your mother-in-law in Seattle on vacation. I think that, you know, if I had to stay with my mother-in-law, you know, overnight, I would shoot myself. I mean, this woman has been in my life for 42 years. I didn't elect for this. If I had looked at my pretty sweet wife and said, okay, I kind of like you. I think you're hot. We have a good time together. And then really realized that I was introducing this other woman into my life for 40 years for the rest of my life. Yeah, it wouldn't happen. I would not be married today. Or I might be married, but it would definitely be somebody else.
Well, you know, you have to consider a whole bunch of factors all at the same time, much like with farming, right? And so part of my calculus here is I like it. I mean, you tell me, when you and your wife have an argument, not that you ever do, but hypothetically, if you had an argument.
Oh, we argue all the time. That's what we do. We don't argue. That's the exception.
So in those moments, do you ever feel that you're not on an even playing field? Do you ever feel that like you're somehow got to, if it's a soccer metaphor, you just got to kind of kick it uphill or, you know, throw the ball uphill, whatever.
Every single time. Yeah.
Right. Time. So that's why, you know, I like it when I stay with my mother-in-law because it's kind of tilting the pitch back in my favor.
Oh,
right.
So what you're saying is your wife and mother-in-law are not in the same place. They're kind of like, you know,
well, they will typically be in the same place. But if there's a point where, you know, my wife and I are disagreeing about something and, you know, mother-in-law is in the room, she's going to skew it towards my side more often than not. Now, that's not to say that's
a
universe. Yeah. Well, see, look, it's you got
40 freaking years. I have truly never experienced anything close to that. What I love particularly is my twice divorced. Ooh, this is going to really get deep. My twice divorced mother-in-law giving my wife marriage advice for us after we've been married 30 years and combined, she was married like 12.
Well, it's funny. I feel like once you have kids, you start to kind of re-examine some of your own upbringing. And, you know, like I think about like when my son was four, that's when I started, he's 12 now. When he was four, I started thinking about, okay, what were kind of my experiences at the same time when I was four, you know, lessons that I learned, lessons that I was parented. And I think, you know, it winds up sometimes being a corner solution, right? You can get really, really good advice. You're like, oh, that's what was instilled into me. And I'm going to take this and I'm going to apply it in my adult life. And this is going to carry through with me for the rest. Or you're learning by counterexample. You know, okay, and so maybe that's part of it. Maybe you're learning by counterexample.
All right. Well, so, yeah, okay. So wait a minute. Do you actually remember anything from when you were four?
Yeah, a little bit. I lived in Baltimore.
Okay. So, you know, you lived in Baltimore. Do you remember, Catherine, do you remember anything when you were four?
No, not okay, at all. But
I remember two things when I was four. Two. One, I got pissed off and I put my arm out to go out my grandmother's storm door and put it right through the glass. That was before they had plexiglass, you know, so it went right through and cut me all up through the arm. I remember that. And then I remember a tornado that came over the farm and I was like, probably shit my pants. We probably ought to bleep that word out. Okay. Wait a minute. We're way off subject.
Hold on. Can I tell you my four-year-old story? Can I tell you my 4-year old story? Right. Cause it'll kind of reconcile a little bit with the first one that you told, right? So, you know, going back to parental advice and the things that you learn, I remember, I don't know, one Sunday morning or whatever, I was sitting with my dad. Maybe we were reading the, you know, funnies in the paper, newspapers. Remember those? That was a thing that was in the 80s. That was fun.
What do you get it? I read a newspaper till like 5 years ago.
I was reading them until probably 2011, 2012. And then everything started moving digital. You started having like much less content to actually hold on to. But at that point, I was in, you know, working in DC. So we still had like, you know, major papers.
Yeah, but the Hill, anyway, you know, Post and all that good stuff.
Exactly. So, you know, living, you know, like going back to the 80s, reading paper with my dad or something. And he made a comment. He's like, you know, some people are not too bright. Some people are kind of dumb. I don't know what story he was reading. And so I thought that was kind of funny. That's a funny turn of phrase. And so a couple of days later, I was just on the playground in,
We get that today from TikTok. You can scroll TikTok. If it's not just some people, these people are stupid.
Most
that's
people. A common thing. Yeah.
On my the old George Carlin adage. Yeah, well, so yeah. I'm on the playground, right? And I'm saying this to myself, like, yeah, some people are not too bright, some people kind of dumb. And then you know what I proceed to do? I proceed to, like, you know, there's this wrought iron fence, and, you know, stick my head through it, and all of a sudden I can't get my head back. Like, my head's just stuck there. It brings the whole preschool class over with my teacher. They eventually, like, get me to wedge my dumb little head back out, and I get out. And I think at the moment, you know, I can't validate this. Obviously, I know that all that happened, but I think if there was a thought going through my head in the moment, it was, wow, I'm really glad I only said that to myself before I did that.
You know, what's interesting about that, if that had happened today, you would be all over Chinese TikTok with saying stupid American.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
no question.
We're off subject. Okay, this is not, you know, advice on your family and early childhood dreams with Todd, Kat, and Mac. Welcome to Stalk Talk. Catherine, cue the intro.
And we're back. Thanks for joining us today, Mac.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. For those who don't know, Mac is actually one of our breakout speakers for the annual conference. We've had the pleasure of connecting several times. We actually connected a couple days ago, or was it yesterday? And we discovered that all of our children love roller coasters. And so we talked about roller coasters and amusement parks and everything. So that was fun.
I thought all children loved roller coasters.
No, not all children love roller coasters. All children are not created equal. They just have the elite ones who love roller coasters.
It's funny. The last theme park I went to, I went with my son and a couple of his buddies. And first off, they just ditched me the whole time. But, you know, I did get to ride a couple rides. And afterwards, I found out that the other two kids didn't like them at all, didn't really enjoy roller coasters. It was just kind of like, I think it was just Jack's force of personality that, made them all go along with it. But he loves them. His little sister is six. She's not quite there yet. She's not quite tall enough, but she's got the daredevil approach that she will be partaking, I think, very, very much in the coming years. So.
I love it. So yeah, we're excited to have Mac at our annual conference. We wanted to bring you onto this podcast to kind of high level talk about maybe your background, you know, what you're going to talk about at the breakout. We obviously don't want to give it all away, but to kind of tease our members to, you know, listen to this and be like, that's one I want to go to. So I'll kind of hand it over to you, Mac. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, it's been an interesting arc. And first off, and I'll say this when we do the breakout, you know, because I've talked in front of many, many farm and ag audiences over the years. And the first thing I just want to get everyone grounded on is I don't come from an agricultural background growing up. I don't come from a farm background or production or anything. It's something that I'm very fortunate that over the duration of, you know, my education and then career, you know, I've really found a home and passion for the world of agriculture. So, and part of that comes from getting to view it from a couple different vantage points. So out of college, I worked in the federal government, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, was an entry-level economist, and mercifully got put on the food and ag team. So this was my first real professional introduction to the world of agricultural data. I covered livestock and meat, as well as a whole bunch of consumer packaged goods industries and, cotton farming as well. And so, you know, it's just a little, you know, kind of towing the waters of ag data, really understanding things, that are happening domestically, but also keeping an eye on international markets. I'll probably tell a couple stories from that point in time around, you know, shifts in the pork trade related to China, you know, things happening in cotton markets, you know, all where, you know, you can have something happen on the other side of the world, be it a production disruption or maybe, a demand side shock, and you see it rip all the way back into the economy in the United States and trickle back to the farm and production as well. So that's where it all starts. Farms are connected to everything.
Let me back you up just a little bit. we came to you first. You were with the United Soybean Board.
Mm-hmm. I was,
and,
yeah.
And so let me back up, because you mentioned school, but you didn't mention a school, which, of course, you know, that's inherently important to all of us, so we can judge what, you know, your educational and football capacity and that kind of stuff. So where'd you go to school? Let's go back that far. And you're, I take it, an econ or ag econ major?
Yeah. Yeah. So I studied economics, undergraduate degree from Vassar College. So,
Christ. So what you're telling me is you're a smart dude. Does Vassar even have a freaking football team?
So this is what I was going to say, Todd, is like, I think I'll acquit myself on box number one and say, yeah, it's a good school. But box number two is challenging because, no, it doesn't have a football team.
It doesn't have a football team. What kind of college, what kind of educational institution
look,
is this?
Look, you know, going back to Jack and Roller Coaster Dude, he's also, you know, he plays wideout in his middle school team. And I'll say this, he's only considering D1 schools. He ain't looking at Vassar. Vassar, not only did we not have a football team, it, as I recall, is against the school charter. Because it was originally a women's college, and then
that's not a bad thing. I can see advantages of going there.
Look, you know,
it's
when
a
you're
women's
applying,
college. It, I mean, I can see advantages
when you're applying as a 17-year-old, you know, college senior, high school senior. You know, there's certain things that are high on your priority list, and for me, not having a poor curriculum was high on my priority list. Ambassadors doesn't have a poor curriculum.
I got to tell you, so all of a sudden, you know, I'm feeling kind of dumb here because I'm thinking, all right, as a 17-year-old, you know, high school senior, and I was thinking about going to school, it's like, well, I want to be a Razorback, want to go to Arkansas. What? That was all that was on my mind. You obviously were thinking about education and women, which clearly more intelligent.
Well, you know, what's crazy, though, is, and this is where, like, you know, I come from a deeply academic background. Both my parents are professors. Like I said, I don't come from an ag background. So I grew up on college campuses. But, you know, one thing, and maybe going back to just the arc of my career and what I've had, you know, when I worked in federal government, you know, did that for 7 years, worked for Monsanto and Bayer, and go back to my experience there, and then worked for USB. The best people that I worked with in any walk of life primarily came from land-grant universities and state colleges, not the Ivy League, not, you know, ivory tower liberal arts colleges like the one that I went to. Now, did I get a great education? Absolutely. Do I value a liberal arts education in the way that it, you know, kind of makes you think and stitch together things? Absolutely. Certainly at 40 now, I think the way that I'm able to think about ag markets and communicate about it goes back to having a multidisciplinary, you know, learning environment once upon a time. But it did not get me a team to root for on Saturday mornings in the fall.
Well, so, you know, if your team is really good, just so you know, because you don't have this experience, if your team is really good, you root for them on Saturday nights. If your team sucks, you root for them on Saturday mornings, which is what I find myself rooting for most of the time is Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Just so you have that division. Hey, look, so there's a couple of different things here to unlock. And I mean, that's really kind of an interesting place to start. Because, you know, not to come off the way this is going to sound, but I do see, you know, Ivy League colleges and the education that they give, you know, kind of as at one set. And maybe that actually depicts a little bit more of what we're looking at in America today is kind of that urban-rural divide. Because when you do get to the land-grant colleges, and, you know, we've all seen the election map and, you know, seen the divisions in between the coast and the rest of the country. And, but when you look at that rural-urban divide, I've always thought when you get into land-grant colleges, and again, this is not 100% true, but there is some truth to it. You're in middle America. You really are going out and working for a living. You're getting practical experience along with that education. And I think that that's an important aspect of what potentially what gets missed in, you know, some other very high levels of higher education. Now, look, that's just a thought process on me. What that really sounds like somebody saying is like, well, we work for a living and you guys do not work for a living. Y'all just, you know, we're up there and getting a good education. And that's not what I mean by that. I mean, but clearly I think there is I think there's a nuance because a lot of what we've got going on right now falls around this, you know, urban-rural divide. We're seeing that in every single election. We're seeing that in a lot of discussions on policy going forward. So, you know, you're kind of in that unique spot of having that education and learning that thought process and then still being heavily involved, you know, in with the base of, you know, so much of the base of rural America through agriculture. So I guess as we're going through that, and you mentioned, you know, early coming out and doing some work in Washington, and then mentioned going to work for Monsanto and Bayer. Can you elaborate a little bit on that from your experience?
Yeah, it was an interesting transition. You know, I enjoyed working in the federal service, and I'm always thankful for it because it gave me that entree into agriculture to a degree. And maybe I should rewind a little bit further, right? Because, you know, obviously that first job, that first professional experience was really important for, you know, shaping the trajectory and where my interests lie professionally. But I'd say the first, you know, seed dropped in there actually came at Bassman. And that was when I read the book Fast Food Nation in my sociology class. And really... I'd say
Are you about to go on an RFK slant with me?
No.
Okay, oh, God, thank
no.
you.
No,
I just
no,
want to make
no,
sure.
No,
you know,
no.
He's kind of against fast food. And I mean, as I look that I'm, you know, going through the sanctification process because most of our listeners know that I am, you know, my alter ego is actually Santa Claus. We're having to do a lot of work for that right now. And, you know, fast food is an integral ingredient for the sanctification process for anybody that really wants to be a successful Santa Claus. there's a modicum of truth in that.
I can't say anything. So, I literally have Chick-fil-A on my desk. So
it's really fast food. It's chicken with crack in it. I mean, everybody true. Knows that, yeah. But it's not fast food. It's chicken.
For Fast Food Nation, it's, you know, when I read it, it was a topic I had not been exposed to before. And, you know, I say this somewhat sheepishly. It's actually the only book I read in its entirety in my, you know, 4 years of college undergraduate education. There's a reason I studied languages and econ is just as I had, you know, a lot of trouble reading. But the, you know, Fast Food Nation, just the subject matter gripped. I was interested in how we produce food. I was interested in how we distribute food and, you know, just kind of learning more how the whole value chain works, you know, all the integral parts in it. And that's, you know, people, it's technology, it's processes, it's markets, it's farmers, it's distribution channels. And I've probably read that book maybe 6 or 7 times just over the course of my 20s, you know, a lot once I was working in that first analytical role at BLS. And I'll always be thankful for reading that book. Yes, it excoriates production agriculture. It has nothing good to say about, you know, modern food systems, particularly in America. But it made me curious. It made me curious to learn more. So fast forward to, you know, fall 2013. I had worked as a commodities analyst for 5 years. I moved into management, ran a team of economists at BLS, you know, more focused on service side. Of the economy. So, you know, financial services, real estate transactions. And that was actually a little bit more oriented to what I studied in grad school. In that first role, I got an advanced degree in applied economics from Johns Hopkins. And,
Johns
and
Hopkins.
So I was out of bag.
Yeah.
No, I'm.
He's just over here flexing, I feel like.
Like you asked what college earlier.
No. This is when Todd feels like ashamed of my education.
Why?
If my football team was number one in the nation, I'd feel really good about it.
Look, I'm sure Johns Hopkins lacrosse is going to do great this year, but like I'm going to have any clue, right? You know, no, education is not a function of like where you went to school. And, you know, I think, you know, when it comes to undergrad and everything, I know there's less of an emphasis on standardized tests and everything right now, but why should how I did on a standardized test on one Saturday morning when I'm 16, 17 years old play such an outsized role in the trajectory of what I'm going to have for my future education and earnings potential? Like, dude, I just think there's
it does, and I'm damn proud of that test for me. That was like one of my high water marks.
You know, so no, I don't think there should be, you know, that sense of shame in anything. Like, right, if you're interested in discovering new things and you're finding the avenues to explore and, you know, scratch that itch of intellectual curiosity, you know, the marquee in the college, university, trade school, any of that, like, that's immaterial. I think it's are you pursuing something that's of interest and that's going to be of benefit and utility for the world, and are you continuing to learn? And sure, and you don't have to be in Yale to do that.
So let's talk a little bit. Well, let's move a little bit and talk a little bit about you know, where we're going to go in breakout session at IPSA.
Yeah,
because one of the things that you know, clearly that people need to be interested in and focused on. Well, I'm not going to tell them what they need to be interested in. A focus they need to have. There's going to be a lot of changes with the administration change this year. There's going to be you know, I believe fully a shift in a significant shift in policy around climate smart, you know, anything that's focused on carbonization or decarbonization. Although I did see yesterday that there was a new introduction of a bipartisan bill about carbon removal that it will be introduced in the new Congress. But I mean, as we look forward to that, we've had a very strong USDA that has been focused on climate smart activities. We don't know who our new Secretary of Ag is going to be as yet, but it's highly likely within this administration that that is going to move away, and there'll be people looking for opportunities to, you know, scrape back what they can out of that to be pay for the farm bill. Give us your view on what you're thinking with the administration change and the potential, you know, call it dangers and benefits, both from a standpoint of seed companies and what farmers can be looking to and expect and where they need to be looking towards trying to place their bets. And I say this to not get super deep so we can, you know, leave a lot of meat for you to talk about at IPSA, but to give a good flavor about, there's a lot of changes coming.
Absolutely. You know, I think first off, you know, I like to take a historical perspective, you know, generally when I think about ag and I think about drivers for ag for the next couple of years. You know, we're recording this in late November 2024. And as, you know, we move into 2025, you know, the ag markets and the overall ag economy is not in a good place, you know, and there are cycles to it, certainly. And a lot of that is driven, you know, by virtue of the fact that we have such an orientation around commoditized production and the efficiency of it. And that's, I think, very beneficial to, you know, how the industry has grown and how we've seen, you know, increased efficiency, technology, and really, you know, proliferation of, you know, U.S. farm production and how it's made its way into the world. You know, when we have the administration changeover, you know, certainly the last time that Trump was in the Oval Office, we had the trade war. I think there's a lot of consternation around what that could potentially look like if we go back to, you know, more of an adversarial position with China, you know, certainly our largest overseas destination for soybeans. But, you know, I somewhat counterweight that a little bit, you know, on the trading with squaring with a foundational reality. You know, China is a huge growth market over the last nearly 30 years, ever since, you know, they started importing beans in 1995 and, you know, acceded to the WTO in 2001. You know, it's been a huge, you know, demands-driven sucking sound on global commodity markets, you know, really over the last, you know, 20 plus years. You know, and that's been driven by, you know, a lot of debt-fueled economic growth. It's been fueled by population growth, and we're seeing inflection points in that now. You know, China's population has gone backwards in the official numbers for the last couple of years. You can look, you know, at other reverse engineer statistics and say, hey, the population might have peaked in the early 2010s. And then you look at the slowdown in economic growth. how much more volumetric growth can we get out of exporting to that particular market? So even if we get to an adversarial position with China, and I say there's, you know, kind of a clapback on what they're importing, it's not any decreased demand we see from China, I don't think, is going to be strictly because of a potential, you know, trade war or, you know, renewal of trade hostilities from a couple of years ago. It's also against the backdrop of continued Brazilian expansion, not just of soybean production, but of a whole host of other agricultural products, including animal proteins, beef, or poultry, foreign markets expanding as well. And as the volume is increasing from other parts of the world, we have to think about, you know, the competitive advantage that we've had for a long time as far as being a low-cost, high-volume producer, that's shifting. And, you know, is a reset or reestablishment of trade relations with China, does that also potentially provide an avenue for us to think differently about our export market strategy? Does it cause us to think differently about, you know, how do we increase value-added production in the United States so that, you know, we're able to keep more jobs here, we're able to produce more, we're able to have more of the value chain here, and then export higher value products to, you know, markets that have greater diversification and aren't just buying, you know, a large lump sum of, you know, beans or whatever. I think those are interesting questions. And then that's what gets to, you know, another side of, you know, at least what's on my mind with an administration changeover. You know, you mentioned Climate Smart Ag, but let's also think about Inflation Reduction Act, right? That's one of the hallmark, you know, pieces of policy implementation that is a legacy from the Biden administration. The appetite for undoing elements of the IRA, I don't know how strong that appetite is going to be once a full cabinet is established and once we move into 2025 when the new administration formally is in office. But, you know, one thing that I do want to point out is, you know, under IRA, there, you know, were provisions and I think at least some initial intent for how do we better capitalize upon what we do so efficiently in the United States, which is, you know, grow corn, grow soybeans, produce crops that can be utilized across a whole host of applications, including for energy. So you think about clean fuels production tax credit or 45Z in some of the common nomenclature. It's a tax credit that, you know, allows for downstream, you know, fuel manufacturers to benefit from using crop-based feedstocks or even waste stream feedstocks. But the challenge right now is that it's not perfect in its implementation. It's allowing for tremendous imports of used cooking oil and tallow, and that used cooking oil is primarily coming from China, and that tallow is primarily coming from Brazil. And, you know, just over the last, you know, since the start of 2022, the amount of used cooking oil and tallow that we brought into this country to, you know, help fuel growth in the biofuels market and, you know, that is eligible for production tax credits in the clean fuel space, you know, that's effectively displacing what we do most efficiently, which is,
well,
you know, produce feedstocks on farm.
It is. And so, I'm going to tell you, I'll make a prediction, and I don't make a lot of political predictions. That rascal is going to get closed by end of February. We're going to see congressional action on that is going to stop that, because with both houses now under Republican control, we have seen a lot of bipartisanship in support of shutting that down. Surprisingly, I was a little bit surprised for Secretary Vilsack, who I do hold in high regard, that came out, you know, and said, "Hey, this is, you know, we're going to have to think about this and its effect on other parts of our trade agreements and what ramifications are." And he's probably correct. I was going to say he's probably not incorrect. That equates to he's probably correct. But the problem becomes that regardless of that effect, this is a tax credit that was designed to help American producers, not use cooking oil in China where everything is, there's a lot of cooking oil. I mean, then we've got problems with palm oil that's inherently not climate smart at all and should be displaced.
I mean, you're seeing additional inflow. Just the last couple of months, we've seen a lot more used cooking oil come in from Indonesia and Malaysia. Those two countries produce over 80% of the world's palm oil. Like, what is the integrity there?
It doesn't, you know, it just should not be allowed under this. Yeah, if you want to bring it in, that's fine for clean fuel, but, you know, you're not going to get the tax credit. I have to say that one of the things that has absolutely hacked me off is LanzaJet building a ethanol facility in Georgia that is specifically targeted for Brazilian, you know, sugarcane and, you know, producing, you know, that's where they're going to get their feedstocks is Brazil. That's fine. You should not get a tax credit from the government for being able to do that. You know, it's everybody bends everything out of shape. So I really hope that, and I believe that 45Z is going to be rounded out very quickly. I'm more concerned about the, you know, there has been no guidance on 45Z about, you know, practices that qualify at the farm level. Its sister, 40B, the Section 40B tax credit that we're currently under, you know, came out with these onerous tax credits that made it unavailable for most farmers. You had to be, you know, in a nitrogen reduction program, no-till, and, what was the other one?
It was cover crops. You had to have
cover crops. You had to plant. You had to do all three of those in order to participate. Well, that doesn't move the peg on anything. So, you know, we have lobbied hard under the fact that there should be a whole host of things. I'll tell you the one thing that intrigues me about the administration coming in and why I believe this is going to be a good area for us. Doug Burgum and not Christopher Wright, the designate for the Department of Energy, but Doug Burgum, who's, going to be the designate for Interior. And I think Doug will probably sail through a confirmation there. Doug's a good guy and former North Dakota governor. He also happens to be closely related to Keith Peltier up at Proceed, who's an IPSA member. So, you know, IPSA's got some, you know, connections into that. But Doug is from a, you know, a big state, big land area state that's got a lot in the energy piece. And, of course, Trump has named him as the head of the energy task force that he's establishing. And, you know, I know that Doug's going to look at that. He's going to look at every opportunity we've got for energy, including corn ethanol. And he's going to shore up this. And I think that this is an area that is potentially very exciting. And for some of the unintended consequences that have come about because of 45Z not being perfect and it being such a large portion, I think that's going to get fixed. I think that parts of the Inflation Reduction Act and sustainable aviation fuel and clean fuel credits and things of that nature, I think that'll be part of the energy policy going forward. And I think the right people are there to help it get done, despite that Christopher Wright's kind of a climate denier. So,
you know, I share your optimism here too, because, you know, the fact is, you know, going back to what you're saying a few minutes ago, just about urban rural divide and, you know, where we are in terms of polarization, you know, I think as a country politically, you know, when it comes to biofuels, I really feel like there's something for everybody, right? If you're an environmentalist and, you know, you're kind of, you know, more on, you know, a certain end of the political spectrum, this is a push for decarbonizing the economy. This is all, you know, positive benefit for the environment. And I'd say, you know, if you're on the other end of the political spectrum, it's like a lot more interest in, you know, the farm economy and making sure that we keep, you know, some better degree of survivability among, you know, the rural economy. Because, you know, let's be real, the last 40 years or so, we've seen the rural economy really get hollowed out across this country. Yeah. I would love to see, you know, restoration of strength there. But between those two, biofuels just seems like something that should have the bipartisan support because it does address the issues and I'd say things that are center of mind for, you know, people at both ends of the spectrum. So I, you know, and I share the optimism there. And then to your point, you know, about you know, the nominee for the Interior, reconciling energy and food, I think, you know, has always been you know, a critical task of policymakers, you know, within the United States, because we've always been very efficient at producing energy. We've always been very efficient at, you know, food production and the value chain that, of course, starts with the farm. And now that we're in this place where food and energy are really inextricably linked, and I don't think it's in an adversarial way, I think it's in a complementary way. You know, anytime you can think about corn production, right, the crop that we grow on, you know, in the greatest volume across the whole country, you think about that, you know, longstanding participation, obviously, in food markets, but increasingly in energy markets through the ethanol build out from, you know, 20 years ago. And now kind of this, you know, renewed enthusiasm as we think about sustainable aviation fuel and the alcohol to jet pathway. We're looking at the other side of the rotation, you know, for soybeans. So much enthusiasm around renewable diesel coming from the California market. Actually, I'm reporting this in Washington State. Washington State has got its developing low carbon fuel standard as well. Oregon too. You know, all of these state programs coming together, I think, are exciting for thinking about the participation that, you know, the farm economy can have with energy here as well.
Well, I started talking about let me build on that just for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, one of the things that comes into play here, you know, in my mind, and we talk about export markets, and we don't want to disrupt export markets with regards to, you know, corn and any of our agriculture commodities, because we've seen what that happens. The front line, who gets hurt? The farmer. The farmer is the one that gets hurt. The farmer is not supposed to be the front line and the tip of the spear for every battle we want to fight that doesn't involve a gun. And oftentimes they are the sacrificial lamb that's put forward and said, okay, well, we'll do this. And, oh, sorry, you know, your export markets are take a hit. Too bad. Now corn's at $2. That's not right. As far as I'm concerned at this juncture, we may be entering, and I'll challenge you on this a little bit, Mac, we may be entering a phase where fuel and food are more complementary in, you know, the farming process. But I very much remember when they were not, where, you know, food for fuel was a bad thing overall. We don't want to do that. And I mean, we look at these things like the indirect land use change and how that negatively impacts farmers and commodities for their carbon intensity score. Things like that have to be eliminated. I'm one of these people that would say, look, the export markets are great, but if we have a domestic need that we can take 100% of our crops and take it to our needs for fuel and feed and food, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with not exporting. I'm okay with an energy policy that gives, you know, the United States the cheapest energy anywhere, because we've been built on cheap energy. This country was built on cheap energy. And, you know, being energy independent, and, you know, gosh, my friends that know me well will pass out when I say these following words: energy independence and the target the Trump administration and President Trump has set, I am on board with. You heard it here, folks. Todd admitted it in public. There's a leg of the platform that I agree with the president, with President Trump. So, you know, I mean, this is an area that that I think is really important. And with the innovation that, you know, we've already heard dedicated, and I mean, I know this is in part driven from Elon Musk, but it's also the cheap energy side and putting people in that, look, we're going to end up drilling now. We're going to do this. One of the challenges that the Biden administration gave us is the heavy push on EVs. And thinking that we're all going to drive this. And yes, now I see President Biden has just given $2 billion to really try to rush the, you know, development of clean hydrogen fuel. Got it. I want to look at all this too. But when I look at an EV and California's push on EVs and everything, I understand where you're going. But here in the center part of America, I have a Ford Lightning. Got to tell you, it's a great fun truck. Love the acceleration. But you can't pull a trailer with it. You can't drive from Fayetteville to Kansas City with it without having to stop to recharge. And it's just not practical. And plus, the reality is we don't have the electrical infrastructure that could sustain a country full of EVs. So there's got to be something that we have, and it's an intermittent period where we drive our energy cheap so we don't stall out the American economy. And then at the same time, we can help bridge to a new thing. I will tell you, I got my very first diesel pickup truck, Ford F-350. It's called Big Blue. And Big Blue is freaking amazing. High output 6.7 diesel engine with a 55-gallon diesel tank. I can drive 800 miles without, you know, refueling. I think it's the best truck I've ever had, and that thing will fly down the road. So, yes, I'm not really in the clean energy focus. I want to be cleaner.
Clearly.
I want to be cleaner, but, you know, it's that big power. It's the big American power. I like that stuff.
Well, there's a couple things I want. No, I want to unpack a couple of that because, you know, I think about like energy as, let's think about the energy ecosystem in the United States as a whole. And well, maybe just even just drill in on transportation here, right? It has to be a mosaic approach, you know, where there's a whole bunch of things coming together. And that's why it frustrates me when, you know, there are incentives and signals given that say, hey, a one-size-fits-all approach might work, right? Where there's an overemphasis on EVs. Now, I have my personal antipathy towards EVs, right? If you think about the full value chain, I really don't think, you know, over-indexing or over-investing on that as a growth area, particularly when you think about, you know, the value-added processing that has to go from taking, you know, cobalt out of Central African Republic or and the DRC, you know, running that through refineries in China, making the batteries, and then eventually placing that into the United States market and the passenger car market. I think there's pinch points there that are going to be challenging, again, particularly if we have shifts in the rhetoric with China. The extractive nature of the mining for metals for batteries is also something that I think is not fully appreciated when we really do the full life cycle carbon accounting and want to compare different sources of transportation energy. But, you know, that said, it's got a place in the market, right? It does have a place, but let's not fool ourselves into thinking it's going to be done at the scale across all the transportation sectors that it would need to happen at scale. You, to your point, middle America, you know, you don't have the charge stations. There's not the infrastructure there. Additionally, let's think about the kind of equipment out there. You know, it's October. You know, you're harvesting, probably running a combine for 12 hours. You're going to charge that overnight? Is that going to
run on a battery?
You're going to get 12-hour recovery time for that overnight? I don't think so. Or, you know, long-haul trucking. Or aviation. We talked about sustainable aviation fuel. These are sectors incredibly difficult to electrify.
Yeah, I was actually involved earlier this year in a discussion, and you know, the chief sustainability officer from Delta Airlines was there and made a really important comment that Delta was all in on SAF, on sustainable aviation fuel, because we're not ever going to put a jet that is powered solely by a battery over the ocean. Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I darn sure will not be on it if they do. But, you know, so honestly, I get all of that. And I mean, really and truly, the key point for me on electric, and I do understand we're at the infancy of the electric vehicle piece. And when we look at, you know, internal combustion, we're probably at the highest, you know, place that we'll ever get with internal combustion. We're bumping the upper limit. But my key point on this is, look, I've seen Elon Musk trucks. We have a few of them riding around here. My 5-year-old granddaughter calls them refrigerator trucks because they look like a refrigerator sitting on its side. Mm-hmm. I know Big Blue can run over that thing like a monster truck and crush it. And that's all I need to know. But Big Blue, I'm voting for you.
For two things on the Cybertruck. One, I have a good friend who's her boyfriend drives one, so there's one going through my neighborhood a decent amount. First time he showed up with that, all the neighborhood kids were flocking to it. My son got in it, and he's like, everything is angles inside. So that was interesting. And two, I don't know, when you saw a couple months ago, there were reports of like raccoons that would like scratch up Cybertrucks because they resemble dumpsters too much just in their shape. That was one of the funnier stories that I've seen all year. Seriously, Google that. It's very, very funny. You know, but again,
I think you need that. I think that needs to be a, if you've got a video off of Google, that definitely needs to be part of the opening remarks that you have at IPSA.
Yes.
Everybody needs to see that.
I will come up with a raccoon themed introduction there. You know, I was going to go slide light, but I think now I've got to get a little creative.
Well, you know, but video is always worth, you know, 1,000 words.
I think so. Yeah, it's no, but going back to the mosaic of energy, you know, that's transportation. But then let's think about even the liquid transportation fuels that are being developed here. That's going to be a mosaic approach too, right? I think, you know, where we are now, like soybean oil, still volumetrically going to be the most important input to biomass-based diesel production for renewable diesel, biodiesel, sustainable aviation fuel. But it shouldn't be so skewed towards those, and it towards, you know, UCO and tallow imports right now. Look, I'm not saying, you know, we can't have imported feedstocks. It's just the preferential treatment in terms of the structure of the credits that, you know, basically incentivizes the behavior and the choices that the blenders are making. I'd like to see that where it's leveraging resources that we develop internally in the United States, i.e., you know, crop-based feedstocks. I'd like to see those have those place because, you know, put it all together. Think about ethanol plants in the United States. Think about soybean crush facilities in the United States. You know, over the last 20 years, as we had ethanol plants scale up, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you know, started the RFS, or over the last, you know, 4 years, as we've seen growth in renewable diesel and by extension, major expansion in crushing facilities across the country. That's not nothing, right? That's more value-added processing in the United States, which, yes, that means more jobs. It means, you know, more, you know, revenue being kept stateside. But let's also bring it back to the farm. You know, we talk about energy revolution. One of the earliest learning points I had early on in my time at Monsanto was in 2014, and this was after the Bakken shale discovery, you know, up in the Dakotas. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. I was talking to a group of Ray seed dealers, and this is around the time when corn was trading CBOT prices, I think about $4.25, $4.35 a bushel. And I was talking to one dealer who's also a farmer. He's like, yeah, you know, that CBOT price, well, understand out here in North Dakota, we don't get that. We get $2.75, you know, because in the wide basis was for a lot of things, right? You don't have the local point of delivery. But at the time, it was also really hard to get rail cars because all the rail cars were being bid up for moving energy around. You know, again, it makes sense. Railroads are going to go to where you get, you know, kind of the highest value assessed there. But that conversation that I had around basis, you know, has always been center of my mind when I think about, you know, new facilities and, you know, the farm intersection to local and more distant economies. As we have, you know, growth in the processing space, that means that farmers in historically underserved parts of the country, so take North Dakota, for example, you know, not historically had like a large crushing presence. You know, farmers, rather than having to rail their beans all the way over to the PNW for an export market, you know, can deliver to a local crush facility, you know, they're saving, you know, 30, 40 cents on basis, depending on the market. That's not a small thing. And particularly in a down farm economy now, where, you know, we're a market report out of Brazil from looking at, you know, single digit bean prices again. That improvement on basis is really, really critical. And that's why the investment into rural America, as it's happening through these end value chain markets, is so critical. Bring it back, recap it, urban-rural divide. We eventually have to get past this. And I'm someone who grew up in cities. I grew up on the East Coast. And if you like living in a city, you have to thank the ag economy. Because the reason we have cities as people is because we were able to produce agricultural surplus so people could move into other economic fields, could do other things, you could diversify. And that's what brings the city together.
Man,
and
I
then
tell
conversely,
you what.
I can't think
of a better place to end.
Yeah.
No, finish your thought, please.
The other side of that is like in the farm, you know, you can't be entirely disconnected from, you know, the urban environment either, because that's where the markets are. We have to collectively work together. And I think, you know, food and energy is a way to think about how that comes together. But working together is going to be, I think, just really important and helping eventually bridge that divide and making our country and really the ag industry a lot stronger.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mac, I do think that's a good place to end for us. And I want to thank you for coming on. I'm excited about you being at the annual conference and continuing this discussion around what we're expecting on policy and what opportunities are going out. So our seed company members can start talking to their farmers about that so they can lead the conversation. But, you know, I'll tell you what, and we're going to have to put a placeholder because I'd like to have you back.
I would love that.
I want to talk about another thing, which is near and dear to me as of late, which is NAFTA. I got this theory going on in my head that the problems that we're experiencing today, if we look at cause and effect, the original cause may have been NAFTA. So I want you to think about that. And I want to bring you back and we'll have another conversation.
Oh, but, I can't wait.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Exciting. If nothing else, it'll be humorous. Anyway, everybody, I'll tell you what, thank you for joining us on Stock Talk. Mac Marshall, we appreciate you very much. We look forward to seeing you in January. This is Todd.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you, Kat. Always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Okay. Looking
forward to it.
We'll see you next time.
Cheers. Take care.